Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their fabulous yearly Writers Conference, which takes place this year on July 16th, I believe, go there if you want to connect with editors or agents, or connect with other authors, or learn how to better connect with readers. PNWA Writers Conference is definitely the place to go. You can learn more about it at pnwa.org. You know, I do love authors who can just dive right into the big questions. I'm a big question kind of guy. Not all authors like to do it. Some have to be led gently. But today's guest is just one of those big question guys. He is the one and only Neil Donald Walsh. He's the author of 29 books and counting, including his big bestseller, Conversations with God, which has been translated into 37 languages. It has reached millions of readers. His latest book is God's Message to the World, and he's here with me today to talk about what that message might be. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Neil. And you know, when I got your book, one of the first things I thought of was Jeanine Roth. Do you know Jeanine?
I do not.
She's a teacher and writer, and she wrote a book called Women, Food, and God. That was the one I interviewed her for. And when I interviewed her, she said the reason she chose the word God and put the word God in the title for a book about dieting, essentially, was that, A, she wanted a word that suggested something beyond the physical, and then, and this is what got me thinking about your book, was she said, everybody, this is so interesting, everybody has a relationship to that word no matter what you believe, whether you call yourself an atheist or a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or Hindu or whatever I am, you have a relationship to that word. What do you think about that? Do you think that's true?
Of course it is. There are several words in the English language. Sex is another. Home, by the way, is another. Love is another. There are, freedom is another. There are maybe 20 words, I think, perhaps. What I would agree with her, called dynamite words, in any language, doesn't matter what language you're talking about. And those 20 words or so are very evocative. They bring up deep resonance within all of us, deep feelings of one kind or another within all of us, and there's no question. Someone once made the observation that you could almost go through an entire life with just those 21 words. And, you know, if you're a very limited language, but you could say, you know, home, sex, God, food, you know, freedom.
Yeah.
And could almost get by with those 21 words, explaining what it is you'd like, what you'd want, what you want to experience, and what's on your mind. So, yeah, I agree with her. And of those words, I would probably have to agree with her as well, of those 21 words, probably God is the most evocative, even for those people who do not have a personal relationship with God and don't even believe for that matter that there's a thing called God. Even that is a relationship.
That's right.
In that it's a rejection of the idea that such a thing exists.
Yeah. Now, when you wrote Conversations with God, what was your concept of that word before you wrote that book?
Well, Bill, I think we need to understand that I did not write the book as a book. That is, the first book, the first two books, for that matter, were not intended to be books. They did not emerge from me as books. That is, I did not sit down and say, I think I'll write a book. That would a dialogue between me and God. So the first two of those books were simply translations of my very personal inner experience. It was really basically a diary or a journal, if you please, personal journal. And my personal journal made it into print. My own thought about God at that point was the same, basically the same as it is today, only not quite as expanded. I personally, just Neil as a personal individual, always felt that there was a thing called God. I was raised in a Roman Catholic household. I no longer practiced the Roman Catholic faith as a personal belief system, but I certainly do understand a great deal of all the faiths of the world because of my background as a Roman Catholic. I wound up studying other faith traditions as well. And so I always felt that there's something larger than me in the universe. And I got to tell you, by the way, anthropologists are telling us that today that's true for around 86% of the world's people. That is, that percentage of the world's people believe in some sort of higher power, however we want to conceptualize it, a higher power, something greater than us that exists in the universe that perhaps has been at cause in the matter of the universe existing. So to answer your question directly, I always thought there was a thing called God, but here was the difference between before and after my dialogue. I thought that I was separate from God, other than God, and that my job was somehow to get back to God, somehow to get back to, you know, who and what God was. And if I, you know, played my cards right and was a good boy at the end of my life, there was a 50-50 chance at least that I might get back home. So my relationship with what I call God changed dramatically after the dialogue, in that I began to embrace an entirely different view. I dropped what I call my separation theology and stepped into a unification theology, where I saw that God and I and what I call life, the word life, all three words were really essentially interchangeable.
Yeah, that's where I've arrived as well. And, you know, it's funny, Neil, we're on a show. Technically, this is for writers, but I talk about it, about all sorts of things. And one of the things that I find most interesting about writers is a lot of them are very practical people. You know, they want to make a living. They want to sell books, blah, blah, blah. But when you get them talking about the creative process, about the experience of sitting down to a blank page and really listening is what it is, whether it's really a listening experience, they end up, these writers who are very practical people, most of them don't consider themselves spiritual, don't consider themselves mystics, but that's what they sound like, because they start talking about what is speaking to them and this thing that they're receiving and this thing that they're listening to that's coming through them, not something they're making and building, but actually receiving. And it's a very practical kind of experience. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and I've heard it many, many times. Writers talk about the muse, listening to the muse or listening for the muse, and I think that's just another way of referring to that place of higher wisdom within all of us that exists, that we access, not just when we're writing, but throughout our lives in many, many different ways. You know, from whence cometh creativity of any kind, you know, music, art, or for that matter, a new way to wash dishes, or a new way to cut the grass, or a new way to do anything. Well, where do ideas come from? What is the source of that great idea that you have standing in the shower stall trying to solve a problem, and all of a sudden, bingo, there's the solution.
Yeah.
You can't wait to get out of that shower stall, dry yourself off, and get to the solution. Get back to that computer and write it down, or whatever that idea was. So, yeah, I agree that even people who are so-called practical people who don't have much to do with mysticism, I couldn't agree with you more. They all do agree on one thing. There's a source, whatever you want to call it, that, and their job as a writer is to get out of the way, get their own mind out of the way, and let the muse do the talking. Most writers will tell you that books lead them through themselves. I'm led by the nose through a book that I'm writing. Just all I have to do is follow the lead and get myself out of the way. Stop thinking about what I want to say, and think about what is emerging that wants to be said.
Yeah, that's Andre Debuse, the novelist Andre Debuse. He's a wonderful teacher too. He said he really learned to write when he realized he stopped trying to have something to say and instead had something to learn when he sat down to write. And that was as a novelist. Yeah. So, all right, so we've got a new book. You've got a new book, God's Message to the World. And although it's not technically in the subtitle, right on the cover we've got You've Got Me All Wrong. And so you've been writing about this subject for a long time, Neil. And now, why now? Why this book now?
Because the world is without wanting to be overly dramatic, falling apart. I mean, really, nothing that we've put into place on this planet is working. Our political system, which was put into place to bring peace and harmony, at least, if nothing else, at the minimum level, security between nations and safety, has produced exactly the opposite. Our economic system, which was put into place to bring us at least at the minimal level equal opportunity for all people, if not equal levels of abundance, but surely an equal chance at the prize, has produced, in fact, exactly the opposite. Our social systems, which were produced to create peace and harmony and joyful way of being together and gathering together in groups, has produced, in fact, exactly the opposite. Our educational system, which was designed to produce, you know, a higher level, hopefully, of wisdom and clarity for the largest number of people, has produced actually the dumbing down of humanity. And saddest of all, actually most sad, our spiritual systems, which were designed to bring us closer to God and bring us closer to each other, has in fact produced exactly the opposite. We're killing each other in the name of God. We've been doing that for centuries, not just recently, but more recently and more visibly recently than ever before. So here we are sitting here, and I'm looking at a world that's falling apart, and I'm realizing, okay, all right, wait a minute. It's not because we are as a species dumb animals that we don't understand certain things. Goodness, we put a man on the moon. We've unraveled the human genome. We're going to clone people pretty soon. We've already cloned sheep and cats and dogs, and we're going to clone people before the next 20 years are out. What is it we don't understand here about life, the understanding of which would change everything? And what I think we don't understand is that two things. Our fundamental belief system is simply in error, that is, we believe things that simply are not true. And number two, we've set the wrong priorities for ourselves as a species. We're after this thing, and we should be after that thing. And the thing that we think and have told ourselves we're supposed to be after, get the guy, get the girl, get the car, get the job, get the house, get the better car, get the better job, get the spouse, get the kids, get the grandkids, get the better spouse, get the better spouse, get the better spouse, and all the rest. And so and we wind up at the end of the game, and we say, was this really it? I mean, was that really what we're here about? Is this the point of it all? It can't be the point of it all. There must be something more than this. Or we're going to sing that song from Peggy Lee 35 years ago, Somebody Send in the Clowns, because I've got to be in a circus here. What's going on? So I wrote the book now because I see that everything from ISIS in the Middle East to Ferguson, Missouri, and all the places in between, that we're just utterly and completely dysfunctional. Congress is dysfunctional. Our political system between the Democrats and the Republicans, utterly dysfunctional. We can't even, you know, my goodness. So we just go on and on and on, and we look around and we say, okay, what is it here? What is it that we are not getting? Because we're not stupid. There's simply some data missing. I thought I would just add the missing data as I see it. Just another idea to put on the pile of ideas, but hopefully I think people will see that, you know, some people have agreed. I got about 15 million people who say, you know what, these ideas make sense, that we have to rethink our whole notion of who we are, why we're here, what is the purpose of life, and what is the thing anyway that some people call God, and how do our ideas about God affect our ideas about how to live life on this earth. That's the reason I wrote the book, because most of the laws of the world are based at some level on our ideas about who and what God is and what God wants. This is profoundly true in
right.
some countries,
sure.
and so that's the reason I wrote the book.
Yeah, you know, to put it in general terms, it's part of what you're talking about in the book is asking people to stop looking outwards. And I know this sounds like a cliche, but let me start here. Is to stop looking outwards, and all that list of things you described, the house, the car, the publishing contract, the children, the grandchildren, the job, blah, 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 the hair, the waistline, whatever it is, to stop looking outward. And actually, this goes back to how we began our conversation, and start looking inward. Because if your life, Neil, if you are life just as much as I am life and the whales are life and the trees are life, you don't need to look out to know what it is, because you're it, right?
I would agree.
You're it. You are every bit as much life. You don't need to look at the stars. It's you. It's you. It's got to be. And so stop looking out. Don't look out.
Yeah, and the unanswerable question is why. You see, the unanswerable question, the question that has not been answered yet satisfactorily by religion, by philosophy, and certainly not by politics and the understandings we go through life with today, the unanswerable question is why. granted, I am that. Okay, I am that. I could even go there philosophically. Okay, I am that. I'm a form of life, an expression of therefore. I mean, an expression of life, and therefore I am life itself. But why? You know, what is the purpose?
Yeah.
That's what has not really been answered yet. And until that question is answered in a way that most of the human beings get it, we're going to continue to see the rampant dysfunction of human life. We are, of course, a very young species. You know, we're as species in the universe go, we are the infants of the universe. You know, Bill, someone said that if you take the age of the Earth and put it on a 1 year, one calendar year, for purposes of scale, you know, the whole of human history took place in the last 30 seconds of the year.
Yeah, I heard that.
The dinosaurs didn't even visit the planet until December the 7th. And dinosaurs didn't disappear until December 25th, using the calendar year as a scaling device. So the whole of human history has taken place in the last 30 seconds of the year, using that as a, and that's how young we are relative to the age of the Earth. Forget about the age of the universe.
Yeah, I know.
So we're a very, very immature and young species, and that's the reason that we are as dysfunctional as we are. However, that doesn't mean we have to stay that way. We are growing, we are learning, we are expanding. And these kinds of books, God's Message to the World, You've Got Me All Wrong, at least place before humanity an interesting question. What if that were true? Maybe it's not true, but is it my book is a what-if book, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, nor do I pretend to be supplying all the answers to humanity, but I do dare to ask the questions, and the question I ask throughout this book is what if? What if it were true that at least some of what we think we understand about God happens to be inaccurate? Would it make a difference in the way we experience each other, the way we interact with each other, and the way we interact with ourselves? My answer is profoundly yes. I believe that it would make an enormous difference. So we have to have the courage as human beings to address the question, is it possible, just possible, that there's something we don't fully understand here about God and about life, the understanding of which would change everything?
It absolutely would. And, you know, one of my favorite books is a book called A Course in Miracles, and it describes it. One of the phrases that drew me to that book was that a miracle is a shift in perception. And that's what you're talking about, which is if the perception of what we call God were to turn from something, the mean old man in the sky, the mean old rule maker in the sky, to something accessible within us. I mean, that's just one
and
of
useful,
the many changes.
Not just accessible, but useful, ultimately useful and beneficial.
Absolutely. That just that shift in perception would change dramatically the behaviors that we see, that we are so appalled by. Would you say that's true?
Of course.
In other words, if the
perception changed. We'd all walk around like Buddha. We'd all walk around like Jesus. We'd all walk around like Mother Teresa. We'd all walk around with a whole different idea of not only who we are and who what God is, but why we're here. We'd have a whole different idea. Now, what are we doing here? Bill, human beings have to make a fundamental choice pretty soon. We're going to be faced with this choice en masse, not just individually. All of us are going to collectively have to decide, after all is said and done, who are we? Are we, in fact, simply biological creatures? Chemical animals, you know, just mammals, if you please, not much different from a whale or a dolphin or a bird in the sky, except for that we may be more complex, perhaps a more sophisticated animal, as it were, but other than that, not much different. Or are we, in fact, something greater than that? Is it possible that we are spiritual beings, that I am not my body, I'm that which has a body, I'm not my mind, I am that which has a mind? But what is the that? If we decide that we are that, if we make the decision, you know what, that feels right to me, I am a spiritual entity having a body and a mind, then we needs must ask the next logical question. Why? Why do I have a body and a mind? Why, if I'm essentially at my basis a spirit, a spiritual entity, free as a bird, free to do anything I want in the universe, why in the world would I choose to come to the planet Earth and inhabit this thing that I call my body and engage the thing I call my mind? For what purpose? That's the question that has not been answered. So we are purposeless people driving around, and our behaviors on the Earth are a demonstration of that. I'm reminded of a man who pulled up alongside of me in the highway. I mean, I'm on the street the other day in Ashland, Oregon, where I live. He rolled the window down. He said, "Excuse me, sir, I was walking by." He said, could you give me directions?" I said, "Sure, of course. Where do you want to go?" He said, "I don't know." Wow, you know, until you know, I can't tell you how to get there. And that's how we are as a human race. We simply don't know what we're doing here.
Yeah. But Neil, you kind of... But you're writing these books on purpose. You're not writing them accidentally.
Now you are.
But you know, even the first book, I know you didn't write it as a book, but you wrote it. You went to that paper on purpose. No one put a gun to your head and said, Neil, you got to... No, you connected. You allowed yourself to have that experience.
Not thinking this would one day be a published book.
No, but you wanted to have experience.
Personal journaling, you bet. Absolutely, no question about it.
That was a deliberate... See, for me, I wander through my day, Neil, and there are times I feel absolutely directionless. And I think, what am I doing here? But then there are other times when I have summoned my energy, and it doesn't matter if I'm having a conversation with my wife or son, or I'm writing something, or I'm having this conversation with you, where I feel that focused creative energy, and I don't have that. That sense of purposelessness is just an illusion that has been dispelled. It is when I harness that creative energy for anything. It can be just sitting and meditating, even. And then I understand my purpose, because I'm in it, and then I'm out of it, and I don't understand it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, and I have a magic question that I ask myself in front of any really substantial or serious thought or word or action, any one of those three. If I think I'm going to have a pretty serious thought that I'm hanging out with for half a day or more, or I'm going to do something fairly significant in my life, or I'm going to say something fairly meaningful, I ask myself what I call Neil's magic question.
Okay.
And what does this have to do with the agenda of my soul?
What does this have to do with
the agenda of my soul? And if I can't answer that question clearly, I don't think, say, or do it.
Right. Right. If you can't answer what does this, whatever this is, whatever, if it's even eating a sandwich. No, you're saying if you have some significant question you want to look at, you want to be able to answer that question. If there's some question you want to wrestle with
eating
that day.
A salami sandwich or turning on the Super Bowl or or watching a film or going to making love with my wife or having a serious discussion with my teenage son or whatever it is, putting on my shoes, it doesn't matter. But if it's a fairly significant in my life, I reserve that question for fairly significant moments. And as I move into those fairly significant moments, I stop myself for 3 seconds and I ask myself, and what does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? And I promise you, if the answer comes back, darn if I know, I don't do it.
Right. Right. And how did you learn to teach yourself? How did you teach yourself to ask that question? Can you remember the first time you asked yourself that question?
When I was invited by God to do so. See, I was writing a book called The Only Thing That Matters. And that book starts off with an astonishing paragraph. The first paragraph, and I had no idea where that book was going to go, as we discussed 20 minutes ago. No idea where that book was going to go. I just knew I had to write it. I tend to write into titles. I don't know how other authors work, but when I'm writing a book now, of course, I'm writing them on purpose. I write because a title occurs to me. Driving down the road, standing in the shower stall, I'm walking down the street, whatever, and all of a sudden I'll get a title. And I got the title a couple of years ago, The Only Thing That Matters. And I raced home and I said to my wife, I've got to write a book. She said, really? What's this called? I said, it's called The Only Thing That Matters. She said, what is that? I said, I don't know, but I'll tell you when I finish the book. But I know there's something that wants to emerge here. And the first paragraph said, 98% of the world's people are spending 98% of their time on things that don't matter.
Right. That sounds about right.
I was one of them. And I wrote that in the book. I was one of them. And you may be one of them, too. You'll know you're one of them, as soon as you read this. And so I began talking about, there is 2% of the stuff we're involved in are things that matter. My opportunity, at least on the earth, is to increase that percentage. I want at least 50, 60, maybe 70% of the stuff that I'm doing to be stuff that really matters. I mean, everything doesn't have to be stupendously mattering. I don't have to live that kind of a life where I can't have any space at all for trivialities or things that don't matter, essentially. But if the majority of the stuff that I'm doing in my life doesn't matter, what am I doing here? My father, that came to me, I'll tell you, the feeling, not the words, but the thought of it came to me. I visited my father a number of years ago. Now, he's passed away a long time, but when I was a younger man, I visited him for Thanksgiving one year, and I'll never forget, he was 83 years old. He looked at me. We were sitting in the parlor, in the sun parlor. He didn't say anything for a very long time. And then he looked at me, and he said, I don't understand any of it. I said, what? What did you just say? He said, you heard me. I don't understand any of it. And I thought to myself then, holy cow, is that what I want to be when I'm his age at 83, sitting there in my rocking chair and having no conception of what any of it was about? And I'm ready to leave here any time. And my dad, it turned out I was his last year on earth. And to be in that place of not understanding what any of it was about, that struck me so deeply that I thought, you know what? I'm not leaving my life in that way. If I've got to make something up, I'd rather make something up than simply check out, not having any idea what I was here for, what it was about. I can't go there. I just can't go there. So that fueled the engine of many experiences in my life thereafter, not the least of which was the book, The Only Thing That Matters.
Yeah. So have you begun having, when was this book, when was the God's Message to the World published? When was it published?
October,
has it come out yet?
October,
right.
October,
so you had some chance to chat. 2014, right? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So you've had some chance to chat with people about it. How's it been going?
People are loving it. Those who have read it have had extraordinarily positive responses to it. Not just saying that because I wrote it, that's not true of all the books I've written, but it is true of this one. People who have read it are saying, wow, spot on, exactly what needs to be said, exactly the way it needs to be said, and I'm passing this book on. And what they've done is they've gone out and, you know, and purchased two and three and four other copies and started handing it out to their friends saying, no kidding, really, you got to read this book. You really have to read this. And so it's a very, very rapid hand-to-hand book. It's being passed around from one person to the other very, very quickly. I've also placed it for free, one passage at a time, the entire book, on my Facebook page, as I do most of my books. I usually publish my books a chapter at a time or a passage at a time on Facebook so people can read it a little bit each day until they finish the book, and so they can get it free as well.
Well, that's really heartening to hear, Neil, and I know that the world has got many troubles, many of them conspicuous and gaudy in their atrociousness, but we must take some heart, because if the people in the world did not want a change, they wouldn't be racing out to buy this book, and they wouldn't be attending your lectures, they wouldn't be listening to Eckhart Tolle or Abraham Hicks, or reading Course in Miracles. I feel like there is, for all the trouble there is, and there's lots of it, there is, I feel, a very strong desire to see things differently. And I feel that the response you just described is a part of that yearning, which is more than just a little pinprick here and there. I think it goes beyond that.
Well, I'm certain of it. We are, you know, coming to cusp now with our own growth process. Barbara Marx Hubbard, my dear and wonderful friend, calls this moment the birthing of humanity, and I think she's right. She metaphorizes it by saying, in her own personal metaphor, that we are, you know, just completing our gestation period, really, and we're about to birth ourselves into the cosmic community of sentient beings, and I think that she's right. Again, relative to the age of the universe, we're a very young species, extraordinarily young, and we're just now emerging into the cosmic community of sentient beings, and more people every day. The effect is exponential. It's not a 1, 2, 3, 4 growth process. It's a 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 process. And we're seeing that happen all around the world. And that's why the way, that is, by the way, why the world is also experiencing such extraordinary negativity, because there's a tendency when there's that much of an upheaval. I wrote a book about this too called The Storm Before the Calm. And that book describes, in fact, the stormy times that we are now in and that we're going to be facing in the next few years as people stick their feet in the mud and say, no, I'm not changing. No, no, you can't do this.
Yeah.
No, it's got to be this way. So we're seeing traditionalists versus non-traditionalists now on the earth as those who are too stubborn to look at another way of seeing things are really really, you know, having their way in certain areas, but it's gonna all shift. There's an enormous shift coming, and I have great hope for it, and I think it's absolutely going to occur. But there is going to be the storm before the calm. for sure. Yeah. But that book says nothing to be in the long term discouraged about, although you're going to have a lot of courage in the short run and to face things like, you know, the thing in France where they shot all the cartoonists or whatever.
Sure.
Because we're going to have to go through that birthing process. And as Barbara says, Barbara Box-Hubbard says, the birthing process is by no means guaranteed. I mean, it is a joyful but also a dangerous process, wrought with both great possibility and great danger. Interestingly enough, in the Chinese language, I'm sure you know that the word possibility and danger are the exact same word.
Oh, change. It scares everybody a little bit, doesn't it? It scares me sometimes, even though I know it's coming down the pike.
Yes, except you know, in the book, when everything changes, change everything, I make the point that all change is change for the better. That point God made to me very clearly in conversations with God. She said, very simply, all change is change for the better. Otherwise, it wouldn't be happening.
Yeah, I agree. What a perfect note on which to end. Neil, this was too fast, and thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fabulous.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, my pleasure. So it's God's Message to the World. It's available wherever books are sold, and I assume you're still traveling the world talking to people about it. Is that so?
Yes, indeed it is. I appear all sorts of places, and if people want to know more about any of that, they could just simply go to my homepage. The fastest way to get to my homepage is to use my initials. My name is Neil Donald Walsh, so if you just go to ndwhome.com, you'll get to my homepage. It'll tell you all about it.
Excellent. Okay, Neil, well, best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, everybody, yes, change, change, change. It is all for the better. I agree with Neil. I agree 100%. Don't be afraid of it. It's coming down the pike. Well, thank you all for listening. I will be talking to Philip Donnelly next week on Tuesday. Until then, as always, do something you love. Be with someone. Write something you love.